We'll make a start. We are on sheet number 17 in an ongoing series which has been going through the year on Torah the Sinai. We are up to a very important point in Jewish history. Something which people don't think about that much, which I want to talk about for the next 50 minutes or so, which is the Chasimat Hashav, the Chatimat Hashav, the sealing of the Gemara, sealing with an S, S-E-A-L-I-N-G. In other words, when was the Gemara and created as an authoritative text? And this is very, very important for us, because at the end of the day, our halachic process, even though it's been, you know, great having these last 16 shiurim talking about different ways that halacha works and oral law, the truth is that none of it actually works that way anymore. We don't create new halachas, and we don't create fences around the Torah, and we don't look into verses and pull out new halachic principles from them. We don't, all of those beautiful things that we've been talking about, my columns on the board, that I would keep drawing on the board, we don't do any of that. What do we do today? Halacha today is based on one basic principle, which is we look at what the Gemara says. What the Gemara says is the halacha. Now, it's not always easy to work out what the Gemara says, and there may be differences of opinion as to what the Gemara concludes, but at the end of the day, it's the Gemara that determines the halacha, and all of the principles of halacha that we have today are principles that are laid down in the Gemara. And therefore, if you do not accept the Gemara as binding, the halachic system comes unraveled. Now, the reform movements do not regard any of the oral law as binding in that sense. They regard it as historically interesting or culturally interesting, whatever, but it's not binding legally, and therefore they're not interested in this. The conservative movement, for various different reasons, regard the Gemara as, if you like, indicative, but not binding, and therefore they will, you know, pick it open and pull it apart and say, well, you know, Rabbi Akiva says this, but Rabbi Greenberg down the road disagrees, and therefore we're not going to go with. This is a very important dividing line between the Orthodox world and other more, if you like, recent attempts to try and pick open the halachic process. It's been axiomatic for the last 1600 years that the Gemara is the final word in halacha. The Rambam didn't disagree with the Gemara, and Rashi didn't disagree with the Gemara, no one since. After the Gemara, we'll see right now, it's a free-for-all, in the sense that pretty much anyone can disagree with anyone if they're qualified about what they say after the Gemara. There's no hierarchy. Even though there tend to be layers of psak in which people later don't disagree so much with people earlier. That's not in many ways out of principle, that's just in the practical terms, but the Gemara is the line. And I want to talk about how that happened today, and we'll hopefully get a little bit of a feel for the sources on that. There's lots of sources to look at. First of all, I brought you a little bit of historical context. Where were the Jews in this period? We're dealing with the period now around 500 to 800, after the Gemara was put together. We said last time, Rav Ashi and Ravina, they were the people who, if you like, finished off the main part of the Gemara. They were living in the end of the 5th century. So where were the Jews? So they were in Babel, in Babylonia, obviously. That was the center of Jewish life. But things began to come a little bit unraveled. Even in Babel, which was one of the main Jewish communities at this time, things began to become more stressed. There was rising persecution, etc. Eretz Yisrael was basically finished. There were almost no Jews in Eretz Yisrael. The Christian Byzantine empire was extremely onerous and if you like, had its foot on the necks of the Jews there. It's only when the Arabs conquered Eretz Israel in 644 that life began to get a little bit return to normal for the Jews there. Where else were the Jews? Europe. They were in Spain, they were in France and Germany a little bit, although they were expelled from most of those areas. And I'm not talking about the later expulsion, the Middle Ages. I'm not talking about the Jews being expelled from Spain in 1492 and from France in the 1390s, etc. I'm talking about much earlier, 1,000 years before that. The Jews were expelled from Spain in 613, okay? And then they drifted back and later were expelled again. The Jews were expelled from France in 629. So Italy, actually, interestingly, was not quite as bad. The Jews in the community in Rome, for example, it's one of the oldest Jewish communities, constant Jewish communities in the world, they fared a little bit better. But the Jews in Europe were under a lot of stress. They were there really left over from the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire had fallen apart in the West in the 5th century, and the Jews were left behind. I brought you some historical context at the bottom. I'm not going to go through all of this now. The main historical event that punctures this period is the Arabs, really, is the Arab conquest of this whole area, which had a massive effect. We'll see how that that filters in to the whole discussion. Okay, I'll leave you to look at B on your own, because I'm not giving a Jewish history course. If I were giving a Jewish history course, we could talk more about B. Now, let's have a look at some sources. When was the Talmud sealed and how was it sealed? At what point did they draw a line under it and said, now it's a canonical book, it is authoritative? So if you look here in Bava Metzia, it says, we saw this last time, Rebbe v'Rav Nosson Seif Mishnah. Rebbe and Rebbe Nosson are the end of the period of Mishnah. They lived in the 3rd century CE. Rav Ashi v'Ravina Seif Horah. Rav Ashi and Ravina, who lived in the 5th century, they were the end of Pesach, the end of teaching. Horah literally means ruling. There was a book written later, a few books written later by the Gaonim, the later medieval, or the middle sort of medieval period of the 9th, 10th century. One of them is, I quoted number 2, which is from Shmuel HaNogid, that says the following. It says, Tri Shechavru HaTalmud, the two people that wrote the Talmud, Heim Rav Ashi V'Ravina, or Rav Ashi and Ravina, like we saw in number 1, V'Siyatam, and they finished it, Ubiyamehem Nechtam HaTalmud. The Talmud was Nechtam, what's a Chatima? It's a signature in modern Hebrew, it was sealed. It was done, it was finished. And if we look here in this very important Rashi, Rashi says here, what exactly was this process of the end of the Mishnah, the end of Horah, the end of the Gemara? So if you look here in Rashi number 3, let's look at the second paragraph, Sof Horah. Actually, let's look at the first one as well, Sof Mishnah. So let's look at this Rashi in depth. Sof Mishnah means the following. When was the Mishnah finished? Sof HaTanaim, the end of the Tanaim. The Tanaim were the rabbis from the time of the Mishnah. And you mayhem, until their time, Amru Ish Es Devorov, Dvarav Bebeis HaMedrash, each person said what they had to say in the Bet Midrash. V'hayu Talmidim Garasim Shmua Shmua Levada. And all of the Talmidim would just, if you like, write down independently what they heard from their rabbis. This is in the Mishnaic period. V'loi Hayu Masechtas Sedurus. There weren't organized volumes. What happened? V'sideh Rekibot Al HaSeder. These people, Rebbe and Rebbe Nosson, organized the Mishnah, the Hem Kalalu Ha'amu B'Doyre Shlifneim, and collected everything from the early generations, the Sidrei Ala Masechtas, and they put it into volumes. V'Achreihem Lo Yosifa Ela Ma'at. These are important words from Rashi. After the Mishnah, there was very little added. Lo Yosifa Ela Ma'at. Now, if you think about it, that's a very radical statement. How can Rashi say that? After the Mishnah, there wasn't much added. Well, how big is the book of the Mishnah? The whole book of the Mishnah, you'd fit into something 2 inches thick. And after the Mishnah, there was very little added. The Gemara is this thick. And what about the Jewish libraries today? Like, you look at the books in the Jewish library that were written after the year 300. That's almost all of them. So how can Rashi say, after the Mishnah, very little was added? What he's saying is, very little new in terms of Jewish legal principles was added, in terms of halachic principles. All that was really done after the Mishnah is clarification, application, interpretation. But the principles of Jewish law are very, very ancient. They're all laid down in the Mishnah, and actually when you learn the Mishnah, they're clearly much older than the Mishnah. They go back already into the Second Temple period, many of them, and indeed even to the beginning of that and before that. So the Mishnaic period was finished already by Rebbe and Rebbe Nosson, and they organized the Mishnah into its volumes. Now, Sof Horah, the fourth line of number 3, what does it mean the end of, the Gemara was the end of ruling? So look at what he says. Sof Kol Amorai. This was the end of the rabbis, who we call the Amorai, the rabbis of the Gemara. Ad Yumeihem Lo Yhaisa Gemara Al HaSeder. Until their days, there was no Gemara. What does the word Gemara mean? The Gemara. To finish, to complete. There was no completed text Al HaSeder in order. Ela Kishayisa Shaila Nishelis V'Tama Mishnah. But rather, whenever someone would come up and say, "What's the reason behind this Mishnah? What does this Mishnah mean?" The Mishnah was now a text. Maybe not written, maybe oral, but it was a fixed text by their days. If a question came as to what the Mishnah meant, the Bet Midrash, in whatever Bet Midrash, or Shaila Alma Matemore, or something, a question came up on a Shaila that came up in everyday life, B'din Mammon, whether in monetary matters, or Issa V'Het, or ritual matters, Kol Echad V'Echad Oymetano, everybody gave their own reason. And Ravina and Rav Ashi did to all these teachings which were before them, a similar thing to Rebbe and Rebbe Nosson had done 300 years earlier to the Mishnah. And they gathered them together. And they already had the system of the Mishnah in front of them. And they just plugged in all of these different teachings to the Mishnah. Next to the best Mishnah that they could kind of place it. So what they now did is they expanded the Mishnah with commentary. Questions, answers, debates. What about this? What about that? And they inserted other things in as well. Other bits of Jewish thinking or philosophy or theology or advice or whatever it was. They put it in the place that they felt it fitted best. And they created this thing called the Gemara. And also, Hikshu Kushyush, Sheyesh Lahajiv, Upirkam. They asked questions and they answered them. Sheru'uyin Latarit, in the way that they felt they should answer them. Heima Amar and Shema. But there is a narrative voice in the Gemara. The Gemara asks questions. Ooh, what about this? What about that? How about this? How about that? Who's asking that? Who's saying that? The answer is the narrative voice, what we call the Stamma de Gemara. The background voice of the Gemara, whether that's Rav Ashi's voice or whoever, it if you like, leads you by the hand through an argument and puts together all the different material. It's an extremely organized piece of work, and that's what we have as the Gemara. Now, the Rashbam, coming later, Rashi's grandson in number 4, picks up on this and it explains what happened after the Gemara. Look at the Rashbam. The Ilav the Pasi Gemara, Halacha Kumoise, if it wasn't for the fact that the Gemara ruled finally in Halacha, and we look on the sheet last time or the time before as to what was the function of the Gemara, it was to rule in the Halacha. We would never rely on the Mishnah. Don't forget, the Mishnah is like a very concentrated book. It's not the final, it's not the work through discussion. It's just a very punctuated, very small, but concentrated discussion. But on the more expansive halachas that are ruled by the Amoraim, Vadai Samchinan, we certainly rely on that. That's Hapsak. The Kaven Shepaskim of Kosfor, since they ruled and they wrote them down, Rav Ashi Ravina, Shehem Sefarah, Vadai Alein Samchinan. They are the people that we rely on. The Hakaim Alam of Bava Metzia, because we rule in Bava Metzia, which is the source we saw in number 1, okay? Rav Ashi Ravina Sefarah. Ha'ein Adam Rushai Lechadej Davar Me'asa. Nobody is allowed to make up something new after the Gemara. Elavada Kemoshe Pasko Ash Ronim Kach Naseh. But rather, what they ruled, that's what we have to do. So what happens after the Gemara is not disagreeing with the Gemara, but understanding the Gemara. Okay? Look in number 5. Similar idea, and in number 6. Number 5 is the Rebbe of the Rebbe of the Rambam, the Rimi Gash, Rav Yosef from Gash in North Africa. He says, V'zeh Talmud shelanu halacha l'maase, Spain I think it was, V'zeh Talmud shelanu halacha l'maase, our Talmud is halacha l'maase. He's writing this in the 10th century, 11th century. Our halacha is practical, our Gemara is practical halacha, the Talmud. Talmud and Gemara are the same thing, for all intents and purposes for these discussions. Okay? It was only written after great thought and great, very carefully put together, over a number of generations, and over many editions. Rav Ashi didn't just kind of run it off. They went through different editions and different editions and different editions. It was edited and edited and edited and edited until eventually it was a work which was very refined. As if they said to us, this is our halacha, lemaisa, our practical halacha. They wrote down what needs to be done in there. The Rambam, clearly, also number 6, writes, Ka'ashe meitu kol hachachamim aleihem ha'shalom. When all those final rabbis died of the Gemara, she'acharoni mehem Ravina v'Ravashi, the last of whom were Ravina v'Ravashi, u'kfar nishlam ha'talmud, and Talmud was completed, harikol mi she'amad acharav, everyone who comes afterwards, ein matarasa ela havonos divrehem. His purpose is only understanding the Talmud, not disagreeing with it. Shechibru bilvad. Alav ein lahoisiv, u'mimena ein ligro. He can't add to the Talmud or detract from the Talmud. I think we've got the point by now. Okay, we've said it in a number of different ways, by a number of different authors. That's what's going on. But the quid pro quo of that, if you like, canonization of the Talmud, is that nothing after the Talmud is canonized like it. Look in number 7. This is from the Shulchan Aruch, which was written 1,000 years after the Talmud, and it's the halachas of how to rule in halacha. says like this: Mihu Yesh Amrin, De'im Niru L'Dayan. If it appears to a judge on Jewish law, Ulivnei Dora, or to anyone in his generation, Mikoyach Rayas Muchrachis, and they can prove it. In other words, obviously not everybody has a say; they don't know what they're talking about. But if they're qualified and they can prove it through argument, She'ein Adin K'moshe Huska B'Poskim, that they disagree with what's been ruled before. They say the rabbis up until now think this is the halacha. We don't agree. We think this is the halacha. They can disagree with them. Nobody is sacrosanct. You can disagree. Ma'acha she'einoi niska b'gemara. If it wasn't mentioned in the Gemara, the Vilna Gaon adds, da'ala Gemara ein rishus lahisiv, because it's only on the Gemara that we don't disagree, we don't add, v'alai ligro, and don't take away. Koshigen lachloik, we certainly don't disagree with it, but everybody afterwards, we can. And therefore, in principle, nobody is locked in, if you like, to a sect of a previous generation after the Gemara. This, of course, gives a very large amount of flexibility in the halakhic system. In the sense that the Gemara is enormous and very deep and extremely comprehensive. And therefore it's extremely unlikely that we won't be able to find in the Gemara what we need. That's why modern day poskim are able to find in the Gemara the principles in halakha to answer questions which are very modern questions, like organ donation and surrogate motherhood, IVF, vitro fertilization, all of these nice subjects that we get to deal with on a Tuesday afternoon. These are all in the Gemara. Ah, the technology is recent technology, but the principles are all there. Electricity on Shabbos, all of these things. So that's what comes out of the Gemara, and that's how we rule it. In fact, there is a preference in many ways to follow later authorities over the early authorities after the Gemara. There is an idea of following the later authorities because they have certainly surveyed more material, and therefore this is really how Sak Halacha works. So if you want to know how a rabbi answers a question now, they answer a question based on what the Gemara says. The truth, however, of course, is that most rabbis don't answer most questions like that. Because most questions are straightforward, and they've been asked 1,000 times, and they're ruled in the books of codifications of the Gemara, which came later. We'll see how that works. Books like the Rambam's Halachas, and the Rosh, and the Rif, and eventually the Shulchan Aruch. So when you ask a rabbi a question, the chances are they don't go back to the original sources in the Gemara to give you an answer. If you say to a rabbi, look, rabbi, I just dropped my fleishik spoon in my milchik washing up, the rabbi will not say, ah, that's fascinating. Let me go back to the Gemara and let me learn up the sugyas and let me come to an answer on that. Hopefully he did that when he did his smicha. He learned through all of the... Now what he'll do is he'll either just answer it because he knows the answer, or he'll pull the Shulchan Aruch off the shelf and it'll be an easy question with an easy answer, and he'll just double check that he gets it right. That's usually what happens. Hopefully, again, during the smicha process, what that rabbi did, he didn't just learn a quick guide, like 1,001 questions people ask about Judaism. Like, learn this and hope that they ask one of those. That's not a very good smicha. Hopefully what they did when they did their smicha is they learned the Gemara, the original sources, the discussions, the analysis, and they understand where the halacha comes from. However, when you ask a really big posek, a really hard question, like when Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked something like, are we allowed to have artificial insemination by donor? That was a very famous question that they were asked, where the husband was infertile, they wanted a donor sperm in order to produce a baby. So he's not going to pull the Shulchan Aruch off the shelf and say, no problem. They look into the Gemara and they pull out the answers to these questions from the principles in the Gemara. Difficult new questions are done in that way.
Wait, no, you're saying that, I thought that's a rabbinical outcome, because then haven't those questions already been answered by modern rabbis?
Which questions?
No, that was like,
see, these are, Rav Moshe Feinstein was like 50, 60 years ago when he answered that. And therefore, these are at the cutting edge, if you like, when these questions come up, that's how these questions are answered. You know, how to answer a question about Shabbos elevators is a question which demands a very deep understanding of all the different sugyas and how they interact with each other in Hilchos Shabbos, etc. You can't just pull off a book, an art scroll book about Shabbos, and work out what to do. It doesn't work that way. And therefore, this is how we pass on halacha today. And what we'll do after today is look at how halacha got from the Gemara, which is this discussion, to, do this, don't do this, do this, don't do this, do this, don't do this, which is today. There's like 1,500 years in between. We have to understand, and then we have to know like how psak works and how a rabbi decides on the psak. What is a chumrah? What is a kula? What is a leniency? What is a minhag? All of these things. We need to get to all of that. Chelsea.
Like, you hear about them knowing the Gemara. They never like have a new idea. It's just them adding to the ideas and commentaries about it.
Yes.
There's no person that would ever like say like, oh, I have a new idea.
They may have a new understanding of what the conclusion of the Gemara is, which if they can prove it, great. But they're not going to come up with a, well, I think that these days we should, like, forget that, and we should do this. That's not how it works. The Gemara is broad and flexible enough to allow, on purpose, and we talked about why this was at the beginning of the year, for multiple, you know, plurality of opinions. And therefore, it is possible to look in the Gemara now and pull out a new idea. And people do, and that's a chiddush, that's what a chiddush is. But a chiddush for us, it's like, you know, when we say in Shul, Chadesh Yomeinu Kekedem, we read Chadesh Yomeinu Kekedem, we put the same Torah back, renew, give us chiddush, but Kekedem, like from the old days. Our concept of new is new coming out of old, not new coming out of new. And therefore the new has to come out of the sources, but it can be very novel. But it's not a new principle, it's a new understanding. Okay? Why was the Talmud sealed? That's a very interesting question. What happened at this stage in world history, in Jewish history, that they drew a line? In other words, why hadn't they written a Talmud before, and why was it sealed at this stage? So there are three basic approaches to that question, which I've brought you on pages 3, 4, and 5, which is interesting. Some of them are more historical, some of them are more theological. One of the main understandings is Rav Shri Ragon. Rav Shri Ragon wrote a letter. Rav Shri Ragon lived in this period we call the Gaonim. Okay, the Gaonim lived around the years 600 to 1000. Okay, and a number of the Gaonim started writing an analysis as to how the oral law came to be. And one of the most interesting and comprehensive of those is something called the Igeres of Rav Shri Ragon, which was written by him in the 10th century. And he basically bases his concept on what we call Yerudas HaDoros, which is a very famous Jewish concept, which we'll see not everybody agrees with necessarily, but the generations decline, and when you hit a certain critical point, that's it. You've hit a point at which you have to stop the decline and go no further. Have a look at what he said in number 11. Okay? This is, he's talking about why the Mishnah and why the Gemara was written. These are three extracts from his letter. It says, because Rebbe, that's Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi, who wrote the Mishnah, or put the Mishnah together, saw such diversity in the teachings of our sages, even though they all shared the same underlying principles, he feared that these teachings would not endure and proliferate, and loss would ensue. He saw the heart was diminishing, the wellsprings of wisdom were being blocked up, and the Torah was disappearing. Okay? Mima'at liba, ukudamista ma'ayan ha'chochma, mistalka Torah. So basically the mind was closing, the heart was closing, Torah was becoming less accessible by people. Why? Because they were shrinking. Spiritually, not physically. Okay. As Rabbi Yochanan says in Eruvin, the hearts of the early ones are like the entrance to the Olam, which was very wide, but the hearts of the later ones are like the entrance to the Heichal, which is narrower. Who are the early ones? Rabbi Kiva. Who are the later ones? Rabbi Elazar ben Shimon. Number 12. However, when the Mishnah was concluded and Rebbe died, the capacity for learning lessened, so even more of a decline. And they had to collate their various Talmuds to recite it in uniform version. They also included in their Talmud some things which had been unnecessary for the early generations. Those earlier sages whose capacity for learning was great had not needed to have these concepts explained. But after the earlier sages' wisdom decreased, as we learned at the end of Sota, since Rebbe Akiva died, the wellsprings of Torah have been blocked. The same situation also exists in the days of Rebbe. The same idea. And number 13, similar idea, he says, along came the next generation, and the heart became diminished. Certain matters that had been clear to the early sages, now were not clear, etc. Now in this generation, these matters became subject to doubt, and they had to establish them in the Gemara with an exact wording. In each succeeding generation, the heart became diminished. As Rabbi Yochanan said to the Eruvin, in Eruvin, and our generation is like the eye of a fine needle. Abaya said, and we are like a peg in the wall with respect to Gemara. Rava said, we are like a finger in the wax as regards to logic. Rav Ashi says, we are like a finger in a pit. And these are all things basically saying we don't have any skill. So Rav Shri Ragon's view, and this is very much the view that you'll hear in life generally in the Jewish world, is that the Jewish world is in an inevitable decline. You start, if you like, at Matan Torah, you start at Har Sinai, and you go downhill from there. Okay? We start at Har Sinai, and we're basically heading down, and at each stage, the crystallization of Torah was needed to prevent total loss. So at this stage, they felt they needed to crystallize the Mishnah. Otherwise, they wouldn't anymore have access to that information. And by the time they hit this stage, they needed to clarify even more, and they wrote the Gemara. And each stage goes down, we'll see we have the Rishonim, who had to write even more, and the Acharonim, the later authorities that had to write even more, and now you've got our scroll, okay, who has to write even more. I'm not joking, this is all part of the process. We'll see that as people get less and less able, more and more need to be made explicit, which is why, in the time of Rashi, you know, an entire Jewish library would have been, I don't know, a few hundred books. But now, you can go into a Jewish library and there are 100,000 books and you're still counting. Why? Because of Yerida Sadoz. That is his view. That's the view of Rav Shura Gaon, and a view that I think is echoed by many. The Rambam disagrees. I want you to look at this Rambam with me. The Rambam doesn't see the world like this. He doesn't see this as an inevitability. In fact, the Rambam, in many ways, sees the world as increasing or becoming more elevated as time goes on. But certain sociological, natural phenomena happen that means that certain things have to be changed. Have a look, please, in the Rambam, in number 14. There's quite a lot of Hebrew here, so bear with me. I'll translate it as quickly and accurately as I can. We'll see what the Rambam has to say. Number 14. This is taken from his introduction to the Yad Chazakah, his introduction to his halachic work. Ravina Ravashi Haim Soif Chachmei HaGemara. Ravina Ravashi are the last rabbis of the Gemara. This is number 14. But Ravashi Hu Shechiva HaGemara HaBablis. Ravashi put together the Babylonian Talmud. Again, he didn't necessarily write it. When the Talmud was written is a different question. It may have been written a little bit later. But it was a text. It was on text, even if it was an oral text. The Eretz Shinar in the land of Iraq, okay? Achash Shechiba Rabbi Yochanan Gemara Yerushalmi. Rabbi Yochanan previously written a Yerushalmi version, an Israel and Eretz Israel Gemara, which was not as developed. Bekamoy Meir Shana, about 100 years before. The Mishnah Gemaras who perish Divrei Mishnah is one of the Gemaras. Their explanation of the Mishnah, Ubiya Am Kusear, and they're an expression of its depth. And new things that have come up until the time of the Gemara. Fine, so far we know all this. From all of the works of Chazal, all of these other midrashic works, halachic midrash, we'll talk more about that another time. All of the, if you like, coordinates of halachic ruling come out from these books. Okay? Kamoshe etiku ishmipi Moshe Rabbeinu Misinai. Everything that had ultimately come down from Moshe Rabbeinu. Fine. Over the page. Nimsa. It turns out, he says, Ravina Ravashi v'chavreihem, soif gedoli chachme Yisrael ha-ma'atikin teresh v'alpeh. So Ravina Ravashi and their colleagues were the last rabbis that were able to really crystallize the oral law. V'shigazru gezeiros, they made decrees. They made rulings, and they created practices, and all of their rulings spread through the Jewish world, wherever the people, Jewish people lived, which we know was not that many places. Babylon, a few in Eretz Israel, and a very few in Europe. The Acha based in Sharavashi, on the second line towards the end, after this time of Ravashi, Shechiba HaGemara, who put together Gemara, but Gamri B'Yunei B'Noi, and it was finished in the days of his son. Now look at these words: Nitpazru Yisrael b'chol haratzot pizur yeter. The Jewish people became scattered. What caused this? Persecution, breakdown in society, the Dark Ages. The Jewish people basically scattered to the four corners of the known world. They scattered to the far corners of the islands, Greece, Europe, whatever. But Rafsa Katata Ba'olam, the whole world fell apart. Why? Again, it's what we call the Dark Ages. The Roman Empire collapsed. Everybody in Europe was basically running around killing each other. The Goths and the Visigoths and the Vandals and the Saxons and the Angles and the Jutes and all those kind of Celts. And all, well, the Celts were from before anyway. The Nishtabshu Hadrochim, the roads became impassable. Begiatos, because of highwaymen. But it's my Talmud Torah. And therefore Talmud Torah went down. You would say to the Rambam, why did Talmud Torah go down? Not because we're getting further from Sinai, and therefore, who are we compared to our grandparents? But because we can't talk to each other, because the roads have all been blocked. And we can't go to yeshivas to learn, because there are people trying to chop our head off every time we stick our head out of the window. It's a natural phenomenon. Of course, if we had been able to do what we did before, we would have developed further. We would have written a bigger Gemara. More principles of Jewish law. But we couldn't, and we didn't. And therefore, it was what it was. Let's just finish up this. I'm on the fourth line on top. The Jewish people were no longer able to learn in their great academies, in their hundreds and thousands and ten thousands like they had beforehand. But there were a few individuals left. Little communities scattered all around. They kind of worked out what to do. But they weren't able to actually consolidate that learning because they were all scattered around. And now he comes in with the consequence of this. Second paragraph. The kol based in Sha'amad Acha Gemara, therefore every Jewish court that came after the Gemara, the kol Medina or Medina, wherever, whichever country was in, the Gaza or Hitkin or Hinhig Livneben in Asoi, and they made a ruling, a decree, or a practice for their nation, or Livnebedina Srabois, or for the nations around them. Whatever they said did not spread through the Jewish people, unlike the words of the Gemara. Because they just lived too far away. The Shibbet had rocket and no one could travel. The Rambam never read anything specifically that Rashi wrote. Can you believe that? They only lived 100 years or so apart, and they only lived a couple of thousand miles away from each other. But that 1,000 years and a 1,000 miles and 100 years in the Middle Ages was like traveling to Alpha Centauri. It was just an impossible thing. The Hayos Beis Din shall Oisa Medina Yechidim, and since the Beis Din of that town at the end of the day are Yechidim, they speak for themselves and for their own country. Who Beis Din Hagadol shall Shivim VeEchad Bottle, and the Sanhedrin that used to speak for Klal Yisrael of 71, that was long gone. Bikamashan in Karnachib Gemara, many years before the Gemara. Therefore, no country can anymore tell the other people in the other countries, you have to do what we say. Because they'll turn around and say, why do we have to listen to you? We have our own rabbis. We don't have to listen to you. You can't force any one based in to go like any other based in. He says what we saw in the Shulchan Aruch just now. Similarly, if one of the Gaonim learn in law, kachu, that this is the halacha, and a later Beis Din decides that's not what they feel the law is, okay, hakos of the Gemara, which the Gemara says, they don't have to listen to the first one. And in the Misha Hadas, most of the Dvarav, they have to go the way that they want to go, based on their expertise. Bein Rishon, Bein Acharon, they can follow anyone, rather than earlier or later authority. We'll finish off and I'll take questions. Third paragraph. This all applies to stuff that came after the Gemara. Aval, however, kol advarim sheba Gemara habavli, but everything in the Gemara, chayavim kol Yisrael aleches behem. Every Jew in the world is bound to follow that. And every community can be required to follow the rulings of the Gemara. And to enforce their decrees, or aleches b'tikkanasam. Because at the end of the day, why is the Gemara binding, says the Rambam? Not because, as Rav Shirogon says, they were on a higher level, but because the Jewish people accepted it. People power. The Jewish people accepted the Gemara en masse, therefore the Gemara is binding on the Jewish people en masse. But people who came after the Gemara, the rabbis that came after the Gemara, were only ever accepted by their own community. Okay, and those rabbis who ruled in a certain way, the rabbis of the Gemara were the people who had the Masorah tradition back to Moshe Rabbeinu, and they were accepted by Klal Yisrael. This is a very fundamental point. If you understand this point, you understand a lot about the Jewish world. For example, take Sephardim and Ashkenazim. The Sephardi-Ashkenazi split happened after the Gemara, about 400 years after the Gemara. The Sephardim ended up settling in North Africa, and the Ashkenazim ended up going through Italy into Northern Europe, and they ended up with different customs, different minhagim, because at the end of the day, minhag is based on what the people do, not what the rabbis say. I mean, it can be a bit of both. We'll talk more about that when we talk about minhag. And they had slightly different ways of understanding the Gemara. In other words, they had the same Gemara, they had the same Talmud, but they interpreted it different ways, which they're legitimately allowed to do. And therefore, if Ashkenazim suddenly took on something, the Sephardim could turn around and say, well, that's for you to do. We're not doing that. The Ashkenazim decide, for example, in the 9th, 10th century, they're not going to eat kidneys on Pesach. Why? Not clear. Various different reasons. They thought they'd get mixed up with chometz, and they had bad experiences, whatever it was. They decided they're not eating rice, they're not eating peas, etc. It doesn't say that in the Gemara. It explicitly says in the Gemara you can eat kidneys on Pesach. And kidneys are definitely not chometz. They can't be chametz. They're not made from the right materials. So the Jews of Svarah, the Jews of Spain, and North Africa said, very nice. Actually, they didn't say very nice. Most of them said that sounds silly to us. But anyway, whatever. They said, you're entitled to do whatever you want to do, but don't expect us to do that, because it's not in the Gemara. We're not going to do that. So we'll do our own thing, and you do your own thing. It's peripheral. It's not central, but that's how it splits. Similarly, the boot on the other foot. Some of the Sephardim said, look, chicken and milk, the Gemara already says you're not allowed to mix and cook together. Even though chicken really is para, according to Torah law. Okay? That the Gemara says. So every Jew in the world is obligated not to have chicken and milk. Some of the Sephardim said, you know something? If you can confuse chicken burger with meat, so you can confuse a fish burger with meat. So we're going to take on not to have fish with milk either. And therefore certain Sephardi communities took on, they're not going to have fish and milk eaten together, cooked together. And the Ashkenazim turned around and said, very nice. You're entitled to come up with these rules for your own community if you want. That's got nothing to do with us. We don't have to do that. And therefore, diverging customs or diverging psak is based on stuff that happened after the Gemara. And actually, it's amazing how similar everybody is. If you look at the halachic system, Sephardim, Ashkenazim, it's pretty tight. At the edges, there are things that people make a big fuss about because they look sometimes, minhag sometimes looks very different. You walk into a Sephardi shul, if you're not used to it, you think, whoa, you know, what planet am I on? Everything looks different, and there's time. But when you actually look at what they're reading, you realise, oh, it's actually the same. They've got the same Sefer Torah, the same Siddur, basically. They're slightly different order here and there. Yeah? The actual halacha is very similar. For example, let me give you another example. The Gemara turns around and says, don't eat meat and milk together, and you have to wait a little bit after eating meat before you eat milk. But the Gemara doesn't say how long. The Gemara just says from one meal to the next meal. And it leaves it for the Jewish communities to define that as the minhag. The Sephardi communities took on an understanding of the Gemara that says one meal to the next meal is a time period, which means we wait the time that people normally eat one meal to the next meal, which they fixed for 6 hours, or around 6 hours, because that was very standard in those days. You woke up early in the morning, it was hot, Mediterranean country, you ate at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you took a break, you ate in the evening, 7 o'clock in the evening. And the Ashkenazim say, no, we don't understand the Gemara like that. We understand the Gemara, meaning from one meal to the next meal, means don't eat them in the same meal. But once you've finished the meal, cleared away the meal, made a blocha, you know, cleaned your hands so you haven't any meats on your hands, you can eat milk straight away. Later that became an hour. And according to some people, it became 3 hours a little bit. And of course, some went like the Sephardim, 6 hours. But basically, the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim had slightly different ways of learning the way that the Gemara finished off the discussion there. But the Rambam is very, very critical because he's saying that no Jewish rabbi after the time of the Gemara has the right to bind the whole Jewish world. They can bind only their own community. And I can decide if I'm in your community or not. And if I don't like it, I can leave and join a different community. No one's binding me. I can't leave the Gemara. I can't leave the community of the Jewish people. The Jewish people accepted the Gemara. And if I do, that's called breaking off from the halakhic system. Is that clear? Very important point. Questions? Must be some questions, Danielle. Yeah.
So, I'm looking at the implications that Jews were oppressed and scattered, so they can't come together to reopen these issues.
Yes.
So what happens, like, more and more Jews are moving to Eretz Israel, is what they decide before the Amendment to have fixed?
Oh, so you're asking a very beautiful point. Because you're asking, I've described two systems to you. One is a system of the Jewish people in decline. And what is the system which is the Rambam saying? There's no such thing as decline. It's just a practical issue. And you're saying to me is that the enormous implication of the difference between those two explanations is, according to this explanation, the fact that we all get together again and the roads are now passable and we have the internet and we all together in Eretz Yisrael and there are 6 million Jews in Eretz Yisrael, what does that mean? Not very much, because we're all still in decline. That process has not been arrested, and ultimately Mashiach will come at the end of this period when things hit rock bottom. Mashiach will come and will bring us up here, and who knows what will happen then? That's the whole, some miraculous event that will happen, so the whole world will be different. The Rambam's picture is quite different. The Rambam's picture is, look, as far as I'm concerned, he says, the world can be going up. The world can be going up. Just the practical reasons prevent us from putting a Sanhedrin together. So, according to the Rambam's understanding, there is nothing in principle which will stop us from reconstituting the bodies of people that will allow us to put that back together again. And there have been attempts over the last 500 years since the Jewish people got kind of big time messianic, really starting with the expulsion from Spain, working on, there have been attempts to try and reconstitute the Sanhedrin and therefore restart the halakhic process. And every time somebody does this, everyone else gets enormously nervous because there's something inherently very kind of stirring and dangerous in this whole thing. And therefore there have been people, Danielle, yes, over the last 50 years who have said, look, we're not reform and we're not conservative, we're not breaking with the halakhic system. But come on guys, the halakhic situation that we have right now assumes a certain exile reality. And are we moving from an exile reality into a redemptive reality where the Jews are now together and we can, or not? This of course is where hashkafic and philosophical outlook issues impact very strongly on the halakhic process. Because other people read what the first group of people write and say, no, you can't do that, you can't do that. The halakhic process is Messinai and there's nothing to do about it. If you ever read the writings of Rabbi Lezer Berkowitz, he's very famous. He got very unhappy in the 80s, 90s about the fact that, even earlier, that Eretz Yisrael doesn't seem to have, and the reality of living Eretz Yisrael doesn't seem to have done what it needs to do to the halakhic process. And other people felt that he was incredibly fringe and maybe even off the edge of the fringe, and that's not what you do, etc. This opens up a whole discussion, which I'm not getting into right now, so I was going to save until the end, but it's based on this, and I'm glad you raised it, Danielle, because it really is the implication of that. Of course, this also informs your whole concept of Mashiach, because if you take the view that the world is basically hitting rock bottom and then we have a miraculous Mashiach, that's one thing. But if you take the Rambam's view that the world actually can be rising, just what most practical issues allow themselves, the world will hit the high, and Mashiach is a naturalistic process. The world basically runs into Mashiach. And Mashiach is the result of this ascent rather than a miraculous result of decline, which is why the Rambam understands Mashiach to be a natural process where natural rules work and there's no miracle, there are no miracles, but the world is at peace and the world is now putting all its money into solving medical crises and etc. etc. And other more Kabbalistic thinkers understand Mashiach as miraculous and everything's different and people are coming out from the dead and all kinds of stuff's going on. We'll talk more about that when we talk about Mashiach in the Yud Gimel Ikrim. Okay? But it ties in with this as well. Okay? A question? Little cough there? Yes.
I'm kind of confused because I see a little bit of like a contradiction. So the first view we read was Rabbi Lipshur.
Rashri Ragon.
So he's arguing that the Gemara was sealed at a time of decline.
Yes.
Therefore, the Gemara is incomplete and it's not accurate, and therefore
it's as accurate as it ever can be, in order to preserve what would have been lost otherwise. And what happened after the Gemara was even further declined. Therefore, we've been able to save the day by grabbing the Gemara at that point, writing it out.
See, it's interesting because it's like, on one side, he's arguing that this is the complete. This is it. Nothing should come
right
after it.
Right.
On the other hand, there's the underlying assumption that this is not complete. Because
right.
It came during a period of decline.
Right.
So that's
right.
The issue. So that's the issue. How are people, I mean, we have people, are studying this Gemara like day and night
right.
as like the ultimate source,
right.
and it's incomplete.
Well, in a sense, everything's incomplete, isn't it? Because we are human beings at the end of the day trying to understand a system we believe to be given to us from the mind of God. We are always going to achieve a less than perfect grasp on what God wants us to do. That's just a thing we have to accept as human beings in whatever system we want to be part of. The idea that the Gemara is less than perfect shouldn't really put us off in principle. That it's extremely useful and extremely comprehensive is clear from learning it. Because you don't get a feeling when you're learning it that it just doesn't apply anymore. So you really don't get that. When you learn it, you see quite how genius it is that, yes, maybe on a certain level it's less than perfect, and things get forgotten over the years, and things get destroyed. You know, think of how much Torah was lost in the Holocaust. Think of things that would, apart from the people that were killed, think of halachic discussions that were lost forever because of the works and the books that were lost. That's also unfortunate. In the Crusades, there were wagon loads in 1242, when there were wagon loads of Gemaras and commentaries destroyed in Paris, burnt by the Christians. Think what might have changed had we not lost those. So yeah, we live in an imperfect world, but the Mashiach will come and, you know, change that.
I don't see how you can be so machmir or like strict on.
No, who's talking about strict?
It's not.
That's it's not a question of strict.
Yeah.
It's not a question of strict. And by the way, how can you be lenient? You could ask the same question the other way around. If you're worried about it being incomplete, you should be worried that we're not strict enough. If you think about it,
yeah.
You're coming from it as an angle that I find halacha makes demands on my life. I don't like the idea that it makes those demands on my life. And if I don't even know if it's right, why the heck should I keep it anyway? Kind of, you're not challenging
or,
it in that
or
way.
We just don't have the big picture. Like, there could be the missing halacha that influences this halacha. Like, it's just like the only half that keeps the big pie. Like,
Correct.
Scary.
Correct. It is a little bit scary, but it's scary in both directions. It could well be that halacha should be much stricter than it is. We're just missing that piece of the pie. And at the end of the day, that's one thing we daven for. We daven for Mashiach. When we daven for Mashiach, we say, "Shivane beis hamikdash b'mehirah b'yameinu." God, hopefully, God will rebuild the temple. And the very next words we say are "V'tein chelkeinu b'toratecha," and He will restore our connection with Torah. So you might ask, "Well, that's a bit funny because I might be lacking a beis hamikdash now, but I'm not lacking any Torah. I've got Torah coming out my ears."
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, "Yeah, but you're right, Kara, because we may be lacking certain aspects of Torah which we need. So what we have right now is what we have." That would be Rav Shri Ragon's view. The Rambam's view would be, no, that's not necessarily the case. We're not in a world which is disappearing. Obviously, practical thing. If somebody burns a whole midrash full of ideas, we lose it, of course. That's how it works. But the world is an imperfect place. We just have to accept that reality. Therefore, the way we serve God will be part of that imperfection. But we'll do the best we can. I mean, what other alternatives are there?
Do you think Maimonides Rambam, what he's preaching is an exception to his life? Because we watched a little video, okay? It was an accurate video. But my impression from the video is that Rambam was exiled, he was persecuted, but yet his teachings were spread throughout across many different continents.
Right.
And he was able to influence not just from Egypt,
right,
but the Karaites,
right,
he was able to influence,
right,
people all over. And here he's saying completely opposite. So does he see himself as the exception?
Well, it's funny. It's funny because I don't think the Rambam was aware that he would be the Rambam in this sense. Or maybe he was. All he was writing is that any rabbi that comes after the Gemara is only as accepted as he's accepted. No one can force themselves on anyone else. Now, it turned out through the force of the Rambam's genius and his personality and the people who came after him is that he was accepted by an enormous spread of the Jewish people, probably more than any other individual rabbi since the time of the Gemara. And therefore, because of that, but again, it was the people that did it. The people voted for the Rambam, and therefore the Rambam became the Rambam. By the way, in terms of Hashkafa, in terms of philosophy, I wouldn't say that. The Rambam's philosophical outlook on the world has been largely rejected by the Jewish people.
Yeah, that's okay.
And it's interesting, in halakha, the Rambam is king. In philosophy, the Rambam is, to some people, something of a mystery, to others, something of an embarrassment. Which is interesting. And therefore, we've split the Rambam into, you know, Maimonides and the Rambam. which is very interesting. I just want to mention one last thing in the last.
So Rambam is only for the halacha, Maimonides is only for the philosophy.
Yeah, I'm being a little bit tongue in cheek because they are, of course, the same people.
Yeah,
but very often Maimonides is the one studied by Jewish studies professors in Berkeley, you know, whereas the Rambam is the one you learn in yeshiva.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
yeah.
Right. Maimonides is the one that those guys study. But of course, the reality is it's the same person, and it has to be learned to the holistic whole. I want to just finish with one idea before you pack away in the last 2 minutes, which is brought out by a few people, which is there may be even the Chazon Ish talks about that this idea, which is quite well known, although not necessarily the only way of looking at it, there are 6,000 years up until Mashiach. I'm sure you've all come across this because somehow or other it filters through to everybody. It's a Gemara. It talks about the 6,000 year period of the world, and the 7,000 will be, you know, the ultimate end of the world. And there were 2,000 years of tohu vavohu, of unclear, you know, everyone's kind of grasping for reality and ethics. 2,000 years of Torah, and 2,000 years in which Mashiach can come. Now, if you take that model and you look at the 2,000 year units, it's clear that the 2,000 years of Torah, have a look at number 16. This is from someone called Rav Zacharia Fendel, who wrote a lot about these issues. He writes, "It is of interest to note that the completion of the Mishnah, which represented the major turning point of the process of Torah transmission, took place in 3948. This is precisely 2,000 years after the birth of Avram in 1948. Jewish year is 1948. 52 years after this date was the end of the fourth millennium, which the sages refer to as the culmination of the two millennia of Torah, which began when Avraham Avinu began to disseminate the Torah at the age of 52 in the year 2000. And he adds on in number 17. Actually, the two millennia of Torah came to a close shortly before the death of Rebbe's greatest Talmud, Rav, in 4007. Whilst Rav was one of the earliest Amoraim, he was the last Gadol who also held Tanaitic status, Rav Tana Upalik, and it may therefore be said that the two millennia of Torah came to a close at the end of the Tanaitic era." What he's basically saying is, it could well be that the reason that the Gemara, the Mishnah and the Gemara are the final word, if you like, is because of this 2,000 year segment. That at the end of the period of the 2,000 years of Torah, if you like, we kind of, you know, shut the taps. And therefore, anything we have in this world by way of halacha can only be stuff that we got from those 2,000 years of Torah. Everything that comes after that has to be learnt out as a, if you like, based on those 2,000 years of Torah. Now, that's another approach. I don't think the Rambam would agree with that approach. I'm not sure Rav Shlirogon would agree with that approach. But it's an approach which is based in the 6,000 year Jewish cycle, if you like, which I think a lot of people are into, but which is not necessarily the only way to look at things. I'd like to leave it there. I just want to mention one thing at the very end, is that the Gemara ultimately was finally finished off by this group of people called the Savorayim. The Savorayim was a group of people that came in the next 100 years after the Gemara, before the Gaonim, and they really put all the last bells and whistles and the last little, you know, the shackle of Atari, the to and fro, the questioning narrative voice of the Gemara was finally finished in that period. I brought you a reference to an interesting article that you can find from one of my close rebbeim, Rabbi Tribbetz, on this issue if you're interested in that whole thing. Talmudic studies and learning how the Talmud develops is a fascinating thing. And it's not just non-religious Jewish studies professors that get into it. It's also, you know, Jewish, you know, the Rabbanim and Rosh Yeshiva occasionally that look into these things as well, although not as much perhaps as they should. So I'm going to leave it there. A lot of technical information in that shir, but really critical to understanding how halakha works today. So we will, Be'ezat Hashem, build on that next time. Have a lovely day.
Thank you.